I don't go into government. It's not that I'm not loyal to the boss. I am. I would never betray my trust of Trump or Reagan or anyone else. But I don't ever want to stand up and tell people things I don't believe because I'm a good employee.
Just a regular gym routine. When was the last time you checked on your financial fitness? If you're feeling like you're falling behind, Ed Sedell is here to help with The Retirement Trainer, a podcast about helping you get into better financial shape. Every week, Ed talks about things you need to know to become more financially fit for your future. Learn about things like how much money will you need, financial mistakes other people often make, and how you can avoid them. Plus, details on the Retirement Fitness Plan, a plan Ed personally created to help you get to and through retirement by focusing on five key areas of your financial life. Learn more about the Retirement Fitness Plan when you visit egsifinancial.com and click on Processes. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
Dr. Laffer, good morning. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm going to change your stuff around a little bit, if I may.
Please, please. This is just, it's all about having a conversation.
Well, let me do the last one you raised there. With all the debt, increasing default rates, credit, blah, 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 and Silicon Bank, and blah, 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 what's up? I'm going to let that question go. That's sort of screaming. But I love the rest of them there.
Okay. All right. So tell me, what's your take on where we're at right now, before the election, since the election?
I don't have any changes, but really, honestly, believed Trump would win. I was surprised that we kept the House and took the Senate, and especially by the Senate majority that we have. I'm surprised. And, you know, we really could have picked up several more seats in the House. It was really close, close, close. So
it was.
I'm very pleased with the congressional elections. I'm very pleased with the presidential election. I'm very pleased with the governorships. I'm very pleased with the state legislatures. I'm extraordinarily pleased with the Supreme Court. If you look at the world from the seven positions of political power, now this was, I don't know if you remember a guy named Marty Anderson with Ronald Reagan. Best, closest advisor. Marty Anderson talked about the seven positions of political power, which include the ones I just mentioned. Biggest one, president. Second biggest one, the most exclusive club in America, the Senate. The People's House, three. You then get the Supreme Court. Then you get the Fed. Then you get the governors. Then you get the state legislatures, and you've got the seven positions of political power. The Republicans have six of those right now. I don't think they have Powell, and I don't think the Republicans know how to do the Fed either. So even if they did get a Republican in there, that Republican wouldn't know how to do policy. But that's a very, very heavy concentration of political power in one group. And it portends to last for a long time. I would be very surprised if the Supreme Court position could change in the next 20 years. I mean, I think it really is locked. So all of those portend for a great, great set of policies. I mean, the Supreme Court knocked down all of the governance by department and agency. They threw that out. You have to actually go through Congress and pass legislation. So all of these rules and regulations of the alphabet soup in Washington is thrown out. That's huge. I mean, that's really huge. I think with Scott Bessent in there and some of the others, we've got a really good situation on tax reform. I think Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy is a good, good thing. Now, they've got some things to do, but so I am really very pleased. Now, how I see this manifest, we have a very low participation rate in the United States, given where we are. I think it's about 62.7.5. I don't know what the exact number is today, but it's down very substantially from Clinton's ending, when Clinton ended office. Mm-hmm. So without the welfare payments, without the huge transfer payments, I would expect that participation rate to rise quite sharply over the next 4 years, maybe from 62.7 to 64 or something like that. That's an enormous increase in the available productive labor force. So I'm very excited about the real economy of the U.S. So that's where I am. And I think the markets are showing that they agree with me. although the markets are really basically into AI and that sort of stuff.
Right.
But there's a real underlying production base coming in as well. These people who've been out of the labor force for so long, because they really hate their jobs. I mean, greeters at Walmart and stuff like that. But they could afford to not work because of the welfare payments, the transfers that they've received from the government. With those ceasing, they're going to have to come back in. And that really does well. Let me just talk to you about the Fed, which is the one odd man out.
Right.
I'm going to say this is really important that you understand the Fed situation and my problem with the Fed. And I'm not the only one, but I am one of a very small group that really has a different view of the Fed. And it comes about from being a supply sider versus a demand side Keynesian redistributionist. I'm a growthist and these guys are redistributionists. And right. When you look at the Fed, the role of the Fed is to control inflation in the long run and bring it down to zero, not to 2%, not to that. Now, how does it do it? It has two types of policies it can follow. It can follow a price rule, which is controlling the monetary base, or it can control an interest rate view, which is what the Fed is doing now. Now, if you were to have very low inflation for a long, long time, you would expect the inflation premium on interest rates to drop sharply. What you would also expect is that the real return on a unit of capital would rise sharply. The tip yield would rise sharply.
Right.
What the net effect is of those two is uncertain. But for sure, dropping the inflation premium would lower interest rates. So when the Fed looks at a market, it looks at the Fed at interest rates and it intervenes in the markets for interest rates. Here is a market set interest rate. The Fed then comes into that market and let's say it lowers interest rates. All right. How does it do that? It does that by buying bonds in the open market. And by buying bonds in the open market, the price of those bonds will go up and interest rates will go down. That's how it really controls or operates in the market. When you say, is the Fed going to lower interest rates? What you're also saying very clearly is the Fed is going to buy bonds in the open market to increase the price of bonds, to make the price of bonds higher than the market believes they should be, and in that way, lower interest rates. Well, by buying bonds, what the Fed does is it increases its balance sheet. It now owns those bonds and it prints money to buy those bonds. So it increases its balance sheet. Since 2008 or 2007, the Fed has increased its balance sheet from about $858 billion to at one point over $9 trillion. Now it's down to $7.5 trillion. That's an enormous increase in the base. When you increase the monetary base of that level, you have added enormous inflationary pressure to the overall system. When that is combined with tax hikes on the rich, and bad monetary policies and huge transfer payments to pay people not to work and drops in that, you've done two things. You've got a huge increase in the monetary base, which is like money supply, and you've got a contraction of the goods and services. So if you have the more money and less goods available, you increase inflation prospects substantially. That is exactly what the Fed has been doing since 2007, 2008. And it manifests itself very well in the Biden administration pushing inflation up over 20%. Do you follow me there?
Absolutely. Yep.
Let me do the second one for you, because that's equally as clear as the Paul Volcker model. Powell says he's following his inner Paul Volcker and and that's just not true. It's just not true.
Right.
And you can look at this. I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal in 1982 after spending an afternoon, 4 hours with Paul. And on how he runs monetary. What he does, he looks at, he's got his monetary base, and he's got his open market committee, just like Powell does. And what he does is he holds that monetary base constant. He does not intervene in the marketplace to buy or sell bonds. All right, he does not. What he does is if interest rates in the marketplace go up, in order to keep people from shifting their borrowing to the Fed, what he does is he raises Fed interest rates following the market to make sure that there's never a preference of borrowing from the Fed rather than using the market. So he always keeps the 90-day T-bill or the 30-day bank rate always about 0.25% to 0.5% above the market rate. So there is a distinct discouragement of people using the Fed as opposed to the capital market. You follow me?
Absolutely.
He holds them. He does not intervene in that market. He just lets the rates rise with that just naturally, no effect on the market. He follows the market, does not lead it. He never set interest rates. Now, what does he do? Paul Volcker looks at that balance sheet, and then he asks himself the question, are we in a rising inflation period or not? Are we in a falling inflation period or not? Well, from the standpoint of the CPI and the producer's price index and all these others, the GSP price deflator and all of that stuff, we don't know what current inflation is. We won't know that for 3, 4, 6 months. What's happening to lawyer services in Wichita? Well, we don't know.
Right.
I mean, it's a long lag and all of that. So he doesn't know what inflation is literally today. He doesn't. But what he does know what spot commodity prices are today. If you look at gold prices, they are determined today, and he knows exactly what they are to the 10th decimal, like copper prices, food prices, ba-ba-da-da-ba-da-da. So what he said he did and what he did do is he looks at spot commodity prices and looks at the rate of change of spot commodity prices, the first derivative of location, all right? You're a physicist. He looks at that, and he asks himself the question, is this rate of change of spot commodity prices consistent with stable prices overall? Now, if you're having a boom in the economy, spot commodity prices, we know, rise faster than all prices. If you have a recession, a slowdown in the economy coming, spot commodity prices fall by more than all prices. They're the highly sensitive copper prices, and all these are highly sensitive. So what he did was he looks at spot commodity prices and asks himself the question this way, given the state of the real economy in the U.S., are those price rises normal, consistent with stable price levels for a long period of time? Or are they consistent with rising inflation or falling inflation? That's what he asks. If he finds those prices consistent with rising inflation, what he does is he sells bonds in the open market, taking monetary base out of the system, reducing his balance sheet until the system becomes more taut and until those spot commodity price increases stable off and start coming down to be consistent with that. If, on the other hand, if real economy adjusted, he finds that prices are falling too fast, they're not consistent with stable prices over the long run, he then buys bonds in the open market, adding to his balance sheet, increasing the liquidity until the price, spot commodity price, starts rising again, stable. In other words, he uses this long-term, I think of it as fly fishing, you know, when you hold the handle on that and you see how the real, he looks at it, he's controlling the spot commodity prices in order to make sure that in the next 6 months, 9 months, year, what will happen is the prices will stabilize out over the whole period. That's what he does, a totally different thing than Powell. What he does is he takes money off the market, he reduces the Fed's balance sheet to get lower interest rates and lower expected inflation. Powell adds to the Fed's balance sheet to get lower interest rates in the system. The exact reverse. Powell does not understand straight up from Sikkim. He doesn't understand what monetary policy is. And I just hope I've explained this correctly for your viewers so they understand exactly what I'm, what you need to do is control the monetary base so that inflation does not come. You have to look at it with respect to the economy and whether you have tax cuts or not. And he did a magnificent job. He came into the Fed chairmanship in 79. At that time, the prime interest rate when we took office on January 20th, 1981 was 21.5%. And he was able to bring that rate down. And when he transferred it to Alan Greenspan, which was in 87, it was transferred. Alan Greenspan was right in sync with Paul Volcker. They were as if they were the Bobbsey twins when Volcker left and Greenspan took over. There was no daylight between the two views. Greenspan was a terrific Fed chairman, so was Volcker, but they controlled the monetary base to that. And the way they did that was when they wanted to lower interest rates, lower inflation, they contracted the monetary base. All right. They sold bonds in the open market to reduce the size of the Fed's balance sheet. And that Volcker, Powell does just the reverse. I jokingly, with a sneer on my face, and because these people don't understand what I've just told you. Not one person on the Fed understands what I've just told you. Not one.
That's probably one of the best explanations as to why bond yields are going up, because he's adding to the inflation. I mean, that's probably one of the clearest explanations that I've heard since August. So,
well, let me just tell you, there is the other side of it, which is the real rate of return. And you've got to be very careful there, because the TIPS yield is not trivial. That's the Treasury Inflation Protected Security. I'm just doing that for your audience there. That's close to what is a real rate of return. If you look at the 10-year TIPS rail yield, that is the thing you want to look at very, very carefully to look at the prospects for the U.S. When that TIPS yield goes up, you have an increase in the expected real return on a unit of capital. That's a trigger for new investments, new output, new employment, new production. That is what we should be seeing. If a TIPS yield should get, if you're going to really have a recovery and a boom in this economy, if you are, the TIPS yield should get up to 4.5%. That's the own rate of return on a unit of capital, the TIPS yield is. It doesn't include the increase in the number of units. But it's one machine should get a 4.5%, and over a 10-year period, a 4.5% real yield is quite a substantial yield for a cap. Now, long-term stability is where your TIPS real probably is about 2%. You know, that's where everything is in place. But we should have a very large catch-up here in the U.S., my view, because of the incompetence of both monetary policy and fiscal policy, not to say other policies as well. So right. I expect to see a very sharp increase in the real yield on capital. I would expect to see a very sharp decrease in the expected rate of inflation, I hope. Oh God, I hope. And I would expect to see a very strong market over this period. I don't see a recession or anything coming. I've never been more depressed in my life than I was in the late 1970s. And I mean, 77, 78, 79, even early 80, except for possibly in the last 3 years. I've been extraordinarily depressed on the outlook for the world. The whole world has been in a period of senescence, of decline since 2000. We've had a little really decline in the whole world. You look at all these other countries and everyone's just behaving badly. And I've been depressed. Those are the two periods I was really depressed. I was shocked out of my depression in the late 70s, early 80s by Ronald Reagan, by the tax policies, by Fed. The whole shebang there, Paul Volcker, Ronald Reagan, the whole team, was a magnificent period. You had Prop 13 in California in 1978. You had Steiger Hansen in 1978. You had Paul Volcker in 1979. You had the Reagan tax cuts. And I went into a period of massive euphoria. And I am just about ready to completely concede and fall victim to massive euphoria again on my part. I have never been more excited, and I've never had a bigger shift in my expectations of the future than I had in the late 70s to the early 80s, and in the period, the last 2 years, and my prospects for going forward. I hope that really clarifies it for you. You can see why I'm really worried about the Fed, and I'll take you a little bit further if I can with you. Another way I look at it, I get my arms around the trunk of the tree, is that I look at government policy in the economy, and I break it into five categories. All right, there's tax policy, spending policy, monetary policy, regulatory policy, and trade policy. Those are the five. I've gone through the monetary policy with you pretty clearly, I think.
Right. Yep.
I think Powell's a real mistake. Jokingly, I say that Paul Volcker told his staff what he was going to do. And Jeremy Powell asked his staff, "What should I do?" Just no leadership there at all. And it's not because he's a bad guy or because his parents weren't wed when he was born or anything like that. It's he just doesn't know it. And he doesn't know it, which is the greatest form of hubris.
And we've been seeing that for the last couple of years. I mean, you know,
you sure have.
It's not like this is a shock to anyone. It's where we're at because of his failed Well, lack of inaction.
And also all of his fellow board members, they aren't competent and they do not understand a price rule. And they don't understand Paul Volcker and they don't understand what we did in the early 80s, late 70s with Paul Volcker. They just don't get it. So I'm going to drop Fed off the discussion there and just look at the other four. Tax policy, what you want on tax policy is the lowest possible tax rate on the broadest possible tax base. That's what you want. Now, Biden has been going taxing on the rich and doing all this other stuff, and he has gone in the exact opposite direction. He's been lowering the lowest tax rates and increasing the highest tax rates. He's making it less flat and more exemptions, more deductions, more exclusions. I could go on that. Biden has been moving away from the North Star, and I think Trump is going to move radically towards the North Star, dropping rates dramatically. You looked at all of his proposals there. They are all lowering the top rates, broadening the base, and really getting in there and getting this thing going. So 180-degree shift on tax policy. You with me?
So do you think he's going to go more towards a VAT?
A flat tax. I mean, he's going to do just what Reagan did. I mean, when we came in office in January, Tony Thistle, I don't know how familiar your listeners are, but when we came in, the highest marginal income tax rate was 70%.
Yes.
We dropped it to 28%. There were 11 tax brackets. We took it down to 2 tax brackets. We dropped the corporate rate from 46% to 34%. All right. And we got rid of all of these deductions, exemptions, exclusions, write-offs, omissions, all that crap on the codes.
Right.
And so we dropped the rate from 70 to 28%. All right. And there were 2 rates then, 15 and 28. That's moving right towards that North Star. Now, that back then, income taxes were by far more important than other taxes. What Trump did was in his first term, he took that corporate tax from 34 to 21%. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, what he's going to do is I think he's going to lower further, I would guess. I don't know from him, but he's talked about it. He's talked about even eliminating the income tax in its entirety. He's talking about all these things on tips. You get rid of taxes on tips, which makes all the sense in the world. You get rid of taxes on overtime, which is cutting the marginal rates just beautifully. Deduction of interest on loans for cars. It should be there because as long as you pay taxes on interest income, you should be able to subtract costs on interest expense. I mean, that's just good economics. And people outside of the U.S., I mean, who work in Hong Kong should not be taxed way more than other people's countries, people working in Hong Kong. These are just common sense, good economic. I think he's going to do a lot of these and he might do some big reforms. We'll see. But he's going to move towards the North Star. Biden moved away from the North Star. Government spending. I mean, I can't tell you anything more than just let me say Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. It tells you what he thinks. You need to, beyond what the government does well, which is a very substantial positive to the economy, military, roads, judiciary, schools. You got to have that stuff. But anything beyond that's a transfer payment, and it causes the economy to be weaker. You got to get rid of all that crap. Who ever heard of an economy spending its way into prosperity? It's stupid. Or taxing its
way. Makes no sense. There's no common sense involved.
No common sense process.
Yeah.
So the spending North Star is spending restraint. And I think he's going to move hugely in that direction. Exact opposite of what Biden did. All right. I think those are two that Donald Trump's going to be just great on.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Sure.
All right. So with Doge, Musk and Ramaswamy are talking about eliminating government jobs, and they were floating out their 2 years worth of severance so that they can find other jobs. And then I've actually heard people being incentivized to get another job and actually be able to double dip during that time period. Right.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about having a higher participation rate, you were saying adding, 2 to 3% participation in the labor
force
is ginormous. Do you think that I'm going to combine that with tariffs and the tax policy? Do you think the inaction or the action of tariffs and negotiations is going to be able to add jobs to our labor force here in the U.S. that's going to actually be able to, when Musk and Ramaswamy cut those federal jobs, that they're going to have a place to go to?
Yeah, you're bringing so many issues. My specialty as an economist professor is to try to separate out the effective issues there rather than try and mix them all together. Did you like the soup when I put 300 elements into it? Let me go on Ramaswamy and Elon Musk. They must find a way of putting in an incentive structure in government that causes increases in productivity, that people are rewarded for increases in productivity at the government level. and they're rewarded for getting rid of waste in the government. It's got to be imposing an incentive structure, because if you don't internalize that incentive structure, you're never going to bring down government spending and wasteful spending. And as it is now, there's a huge bias against any type of bonuses for doing a good job, penalties for doing a bad job. They're all union members. You can't fire them. They're civil servants, blah, 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 blah. I hope that's the direction they go, rather than trying to themselves pick out what's wasteful, what's good, and do that. I hope they do that. They need to impose a system through the OMB, and it only can be done through the OMB. I was the first chief economist when the OMB was formed in 1970 under George Shultz. I was right there on the birth of the OMB. They are the department that has to put through these incentives. Now let me go to the trade and all that stuff, and let me bring them back together with you.
Mm-hmm.
What I think Trump does with trade, it is true that tariffs do add revenue to the federal government. That's how we ran the federal government up until, I think almost 1910. It is also true that tariffs do protect domestic industries. But I think Trump's real specialty is that he uses tariffs as a club to bring people to the negotiation table to negotiate free trade. And that's what he did with USMCA. That's what he did with the deal with Japan. That's what he did with the deal with South Korea, with Brazil, with Ecuador. I think he's the master negotiator. And I think he will come through with one of the greatest periods of trade freer trade than protectionism. And he will use those tariffs, because all these people care about is access to the U.S. market. And if you threaten them with lack of access to the U.S. market, they will come and negotiate. And these countries are all far more protectionist than we are. And if we can get them to reduce their tariffs, their quotas, their non-tariff barriers, that will be an enormous stimulus for the economy and very positive for all aspects of the economy. That covers trade, I hope, pretty much for you, though.
Yep, North Star. Absolutely.
Free trade is the North Star, and Biden's the worst of that. Sanctions are the stupidest things I've ever heard. But if you look at regulations, which is the other major kingdom of macroeconomics, that I didn't discuss. I mean, XL pipeline, energy. I mean, what could not be better? Medical transparency. Trump has proven himself to be the master of medical transparency. 20% of GDP. You don't know what the prices of your health care are or what the benefits are. You have no idea. Your doctor doesn't know what a CAT scan costs. No one does, except for the transactions that occur at the end of the week between the hospital and the insurance company. And then the differences between one insurance company in the same hospital and another one in the same week can be by a factor of 5 difference in the transfer price. So, you know, we don't. That is huge. There are lots of other regulatory things he's going to go after. But I think on regulation, he's going to be moving us much more towards that North Star. So these are the reasons why I'm delusionally, exuberantly happy and really full with hope and euphoria going forward. In all 5 kingdoms, taxes, spending, money, regulations, and trade, I think Trump is moving us towards the North Star, and that Biden moved us away from the North Star. That's the message I'd like to convey to you and to your viewers, is that, you know, I've not seen such a combination in a long, long time. I've tried to give you my tools, the 7 positions of political power. We own it. And I have the 5 pillars of prosperity. We own them too. And the appointments so far, I mean, Scott Bessent, I know quite well. He came out here and spent a full day with me just by himself 5 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
And he's a Yaley. I'm a Yaley, by the way. And, you know, he's very competent. He knows his markets, you know, and he understands his role as Secretary of the Treasury. He's not going to sit there and flip his boss off. He's going to work with Trump and carry out. Trump is the CEO. All right. He may be the division head, but Trump's the CEO. And when you accept the job as Secretary of the Treasury, when you say, yes, sir, I'll do it, that means I'm willing to follow your leadership. When you go to work for a company, you owe an oath of loyalty to that company. Even if your idea was not accepted, you're a team player. And I think Scott will be terrific on that. I mean, I look at all the other ones as well. I could go through them all, but I think they're all really good. The one I'm looking forward to seeing is what's going to happen at the NEC. I mean, I had hoped against hope that it would be Larry Kudlow. And I don't know if it will be or not. Larry Kudlow will rejoin, but it doesn't look like he's hiring any of the old-timey ones and bringing them back, except for the head of the OMB, Vaught. is being brought back. But other than that, that's the only one I think that's coming back. So he may not choose Larry, but I really hope he does.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask this question because I think everyone wants to know. How about you? Do you think that there's a possibility that you're going to be joining the
Let me ask you, have you ever heard of an 84-year-old going on 85 in a job like that? No. That's number one. That's just obviously, I'm not qualified to be there. I take naps every day. You know, I go to my farm on the weekend. I turn my phone off.
I love it.
But I do. That's because of me today. The second thing is, I worked in the White House from 1970 to 72. And I learned, I'm introspective, I learned that I really hated my job. I did it, I think, pretty well. I did not like Nixon's economics. I liked Nixon very much. And I love my boss, George Shultz. But Nixon did everything I don't believe in and didn't do anything I do believe in. Even though I liked him personally very much, I really was frustrated as all hell. As long as they listened, I stayed. But I made a vow when I left the White House in 72. All of my 15 colleagues there, the young people in the White House there, I think 11 of them went to prison. It was really horrible. Well, you know, that was the Watergate.
Yeah, that's a Watergate, yeah.
Fudging the vice presidential papers for tax purposes there, breaking into Fielding's office in California. That was Bud Crowe and the plumbers. All of my friends, John Dean, we were all in our about 30 years old. I was 29, 30 at the time. I thought I was the coolest guy in the world. And, you know, all of my friends went to prison. The reason I didn't go was because of my boss, George Shultz, would not let me do those things. Thank God for him. Just thank God for him. So I made a vow I would never, ever, ever take a job in government again. And I kept that promise through Reagan. I could have gone in with Reagan very easily, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I could have easily done it, but I didn't. I could have done it with Trump. I was offered jobs and Trump won. I've been offered jobs throughout. I don't go into government for the simple reason that I am not a good employee. I'm not loyal to my boss. It's not that I'm not loyal to the boss. I am. I would never betray my trust of Trump or Reagan or anyone else with outside. But I don't ever want to stand up and tell people things I don't believe because I'm a good employee. You will look at these people like Janet Yellen or some of these others, and they're very fine people. They're good economists. But you know they don't believe in what they're saying. You know they don't. And they will rebut arguments they know to be true in order to curry favors with their political benefactors. I am unwilling to do that. I've never took a job with Reagan. As you know, I called the shots during Reagan because I didn't take a job. I was much more influential with Trump because I didn't take a job with him. I could sit there. You can trust me for those things there at the time. I'm not going to betray Trump ever or Reagan ever. But I'm going to tell him what I believe to be correct rather than what I think advances my career. And, you know, he can't double my pay. He can't have my pay. He can't fire me. He can't hire me. None of those things can happen. And I make enough mistakes on my own without being incentivized to make more mistakes. So you ask me, never will I ever take a job with government. And I made that vow in 1972 when I left Washington. So, and I'm not going to break it now, even though I give you the excuse I'm 84, which is true. I would never take a job with government. It's not where I'm good. I really am a very bad government bureaucrat employee. And I know that, and I'm not going to do it. It's like why I never, when I travel, used to, now that I'm 84, it's no risk. But when I used to, I'd love having a bourbon, an old-fashioned, before I go to bed. And I would travel to some hotel somewhere, and I could go down to the bar in the lobby and have my old-fashioned, or I could get my old-fashioned delivered to my room where I could watch whatever it is, some movie there and do it. There is a risk when you're down in the lobby of a hotel late at night after a long day's work having a nice Maker's Mark old-fashioned and some cute girl is sitting at a table over there. I remove myself from those temptations because I don't want that to happen to me. I remove the temptation of government by never, ever, ever working for it.
Smart man.
I hope that explains to you my position.
You know what, Dr. Laffer? Those are words of wisdom for sure. And you know what? I think with that, what a great way to end it. Well, Dr. Laffer, thank you so much. you take the things that are so complicated and you make them actually simple so that we can all understand them. And I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And please, you're open here in my office anytime you want. And just remember that clock's ticking. I'm going on 85. I'm in my 85th year. So if you don't come quick, there may be no barbecue. Talk to you later. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye now.
You tested your fitness level, not your workout routine. I'm talking about your financial endurance, because if saving to a 401k is the extent of your effort, it is time for you to start shaping up. And Ed Sedell is here to help you do that with The Retirement Trainer. It's his podcast to help you examine your financial stamina and learn the questions you should be asking and areas to focus on to help you get to that place you've been working so hard for, a happy, comfortable retirement. And it's not as hard as some might have made you believe. Ed's broken it down into 5 simple steps. It's The Retirement Fitness Plan, which he personally created to help clarify key areas of your financial life. Learn more about The Retirement Fitness Plan at egsifinancial.com. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Investment advisory services offered through EGSI Investment Management, DBA EGSI Financial Group, a registered investment advisor. Insurance and annuities offered through EGSI Financial Services, Inc., Ohio License Number 102-06-19.